Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, Ray Smith on behalf of Mr. Palivos. There are many red flags in this case that signal that an innocent man has been convicted with a trumped-up charge, a conviction based on serial prosecutorial misconduct. That misconduct centered on the government-induced perjury of its star witness Black and the government's deliberate suppression in violation of Brady, Banks, and Boyd of all information and documents that would have revealed this misconduct to the defense, the jury, and to the trial court. The first red flag is that the jury found Peter Palivos, a lawyer, not guilty of obstruction of justice. He was convicted for conspiracy to obstruct justice, but he was found not guilty by the jury. The next is the unique situation where not one piece of physical evidence was presented at trial tying Peter to the conspiracy charge. This means that the entire case was dependent on the word of the witness, Black. The next caution sign is that the lead prosecutor in the case, Mr. Hogan, has a prior record of prosecutorial misconduct for his Brady violations in Boyd. But the misconduct here is much more egregious than that in Boyd, because in Boyd, although Hogan's team engaged in Brady violations, it did not, as here, change the substance of the witness's testimony to create a crime out of whole cloth. The trial court here never came to grips with the reality that it was Black's deposition and Samuel's letter to Black that set out a roadmap of government-induced perjury, showing that the government deceived Black to change his original statements from the government, that he wrote the notes on his own in 1996, and have him falsely testify at trial that he wrote the notes in 2000 at Peter's request. The trial court, sua sponte, in a very unusual procedure here, denied Peter's original post-trial motions without requiring the government, after 6 months of stonewalling, to answer the allegations of this in the Samuels letter.
Has Black ever recanted his testimony?
He has, first of all, in his direct answer to his testimony, he did not recant, Your Honor. But that's very understandable because, as he said, as it's the same reason why he didn't actually go forward on his prosecutorial misconduct charge, because he said in the deposition, quote, because he failed, if he failed, he would face far more serious consequences. Those serious consequences, and this is why he can't recant his testimony. If he recants his testimony, he's admitting that he perjured himself at the trial, and he would have been giving up his deal that eventually got him probation for the entire Waterfalls fraud. There's no way in the world at this stage he can recant his testimony. He's stuck with what he told to the grand jury and to the court.
If when this file was subpoenaed, the grand jury subpoenaed this file, and he produced these, Black, that is, produced these notes.
Yes, Your Honor.
That he said he prepared in 1996.
He did.
That's what he says.
Yeah.
Now, the government then, in the chronology here, says, we know that's a words to the effect, we know that's a lie. These are really prepared in much later, 2000 or something like that.
Yeah.
And then he throws up his hand and says, you got me. You're right. That's what happened. Is what the government did and just what I said. Now, you can embellish it a lot more, but just as much as what I said here, is that prosecutorial misconduct?
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely. Because they
actually say they don't believe that you did something. You tell them a story, they said, we don't believe you.
Well, but they did.
We think we can prove that it happened 4 years after you said it happened. And then you just say
he gives up, and he also gives up because he wants a deal on his
But I know he got a deal, and that's certainly good.
First of all, I think getting to Your Honor's question, the government can lie to a potential defendant if they have other evidence that he
can.
First of all,
they can mislead, can't they?
They can mislead him, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. But they cannot get him to testify against another man that they don't have any evidence that he was involved in the matter at all. In other words, let's take a murder case. If the investigators say to the, we have three eyewitnesses, they've got a lot of evidence against the potential suspect, but they have no evidence, but they tell them evidence that they don't have. We've got three eyewitnesses that you have committed this murder. They can do that. They can do that under the law. But what they can't do is say, we've got three eyewitnesses that you committed the murder and that Peter Palivos gave you the gun, which they don't have anything. But if you testify for us that Peter Palivos gave you the gun, then we'll give you a deal which you'll only get 20 years on your murder case. That's what they can't do. And they can't, and under Brady and Banks, independent of the recantation or anything like that, we were entitled to get the information that, in fact, the government got him to change his story and induced him to testify against Peter Palivos by giving him the false evidence that they had ink test analysis that proved that it was in 2001. That could be used by the defense to test his credibility. No jury would have been believed Black if they found out that it was because of government lies about the ink test analysis to Black that got him to change his testimony. So recantation or not, that's irrelevant to the Brady question. Now, the court sua sponte denied the motion after the government stonewalled. The trial court, in its ruling, made no reference to the Samuels letter. The court didn't address the Samuels letter. Then the trial court, in the ruling on the second set of motions, made three puzzling conclusions. First, that prosecutorial misconduct was not raised in the initial motion based on the Samuels letter. In fact, at page 5 and 6 of the motion, based on Samuel's letter, the defense stated that the change of Black's story from 96 to 2000 was based on the government's making material misrepresentations to Black and his attorney, causing Black's trial testimony to be influenced by fraud and deceit, and asked for a hearing. That's prosecutorial misconduct. The judge was just mistaken or didn't look at this motion or the Samuels letter. Then the court found in a circuitous ruling and reasoning that the letter was not newly discovered because it had been raised in the initial post-trial motions, and then concluded because it was not newly discovered, the court had no power to consider Samuels' letter. Now, the court did not consider in its rulings under Brady and Banks the fact that after Black's deposition, the government admitted in its pleadings, and this is critical, we're not only relying on Black and Samuels anymore. The government admitted in its pleadings that it, quote, used a strategy that worked on Black in order to induce Black into reciting a 2000 version on the grand jury. They've admitted the deceit. They told them that we have forensic evidence that proves that it was well beyond 1996 when you wrote these notes. And they had no such evidence. The expert testimony said there was no connection between 1996 in the pens and there was no connection to the year 2000. So they've admitted that they used a strategy that worked based on deceit. We were entitled to that information on Boyd, Your Honor, Boyd and Banks. Neither Banks nor Boyd is dependent. This is very important because of the documents. the government refusal to turn over documents favorable to the defense. It doesn't depend on that. In Boyd, it was the government. There wasn't a document saying that the star witness had sex and narcotics in the U.S. Attorney's office in Boyd. There was information about it, and that's what the courts in Boyd held, that the witness the defense had to be told that the witness had received favorable treatment that constituted the misconduct. Here, the government not only refused to give the defense the information about the deceptive strategy of to change Black's testimony, but it did refuse to give them documents. We know for sure that the government had in its possession at trial the February 2003 letter from Black to Samuels, which recites that AUSA Wilson told Black's lawyer Shulman in February 2001 that, quote, the notes were bogus, that within 48 hours he would have the results from the lab proving it. Okay. That's
turn the volume down.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. With this information, the defense could have proven the government's deception because the expert's report showed no connection with either of the two notes to 2000, but rather a link to 1996. And remember, the expert's report was issued 3.5 months, Judge, after later on May 17th, 2001. The defense, if they had this information contained in this Black to Samuels letter, which the government had in its possession, could have shown that Black changed his story to 2000 in his proffer in March 2001 and April 2001 grand jury testimony before the real test results were reported. So it's 3.5 months later, the test result. And by the way, Your Honor asked, you know, could they go to him and say, we know these notes are phony. They went to him on the day after he presented the notes, and they started focusing on these two notes. They had no information at all that the notes were phony. And as a matter of fact, Samuels, in his letter, says that the government focused on two notes to get you to change your testimony. They focused on two notes that he calls at best extraneous to the investigation. They wanted to put the pressure on Black that they had him on doing something so he would plead guilty and testify against Peter. This Black to Samuel letter also confirmed, contrary to the government's trial presentation, that Black did not have knowledge of the true test results until after he pled guilty in 2002, okay? And thus putting a lie to Black's testimony at trial and the government's pleading, this is the government's pleading, that both Black and Samuels, quote, had reviewed the forensic report before Black pled guilty.
Am I right that your client had no financial interest in this restaurant?
You are correct.
But his brother did.
But his brother did. You are absolutely correct, Your Honor. And believe me now, if they had any evidence that he was involved in the Waterfalls transaction, he would have been indicted. And as a matter of fact, at the time of sentencing, which is in the record, they about to be sentenced, they said he's not Peter Palibos is not responsible for any restitution here because he was not charged in the Waterfalls transaction. Hogan knew that the actual forensic...
You're into your rebuttal now, just so you know.
I'm into rebuttal.
That's what the white light means.
Okay, Okay, I'll keep going.
You use it as you see fit.
Okay, I'll keep going then. Thank you, Your Honor. Hogan knew that the actual forensic report would show the jury that Black had lied before the grand jury about writing the notes in 2000. So Hogan engaged in a series of manipulations of Black's testimony that would allow Black to, at trial, to conform to the expert testimony. And again, this isn't coming from us. It's coming from Black and his lawyer. A couple of weeks before trial, it struck me last night, the government filed a Santiago proffer, repeating Black's proffer and grand jury testimony that Black had written the notes with one pad and one pen. The prosecution had Black conform to the expert's report by testifying that he used multiple pads and pens. How do we know that the prosecution changed this story on the eve of trial? At his deposition, Black swore that it was either Hogan or AUSA McClellan who told him that there were multiple inks used to write the notes. So it's not him saying the story. He'd always said one pad, one pen. Now at the eve of trial, because the forensic reports say multiple pads and pink, it's Black himself. Now the government can claim that Black committed perjury when he swore that it was Hogan or McClellan who altered the testimony, or to his being lied by the government that it had ink analysis resulting that proved that notes were written in 2000. But if they do, how can they ask this court to affirm Peter's conviction based solely on the word of a man they've labeled as a perjurer? Black's grand jury testimony in November 2000, he used what the expert said were 1996 pens, would made no sense to the jury. So Hogan had Black come up with an imaginative scenario never mentioned in his proffer or grand jury testimony. Thank you, Your Honor.
You can conclude your thought, Mr. Smith. I don't want to cut you.
Okay. Again, thank you, Your Honor. Okay, I'll just finish this thought. The new story that was created for trial was that in November 2000, Black went hunting for 1996 pads and pens, and Black found right under his desk an old attaché case that for some reason he had not used since 1996. Right under his desk, and what great fortune, in the unused attaché case, he found 1996 pens in November of 2000. But no pens, no pads, no old attaché case was ever introduced for trial, even though he started to cooperate 3 months after November of 2000. Thanks very much, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Mollison?
Good morning, Mr. Presiding Judge, members of the panel. My name is Roderick Mollison. I represent Mr. Lewis Marin. I respectfully suggest to you that this case should be reversed on appeal because the government failed to prove its case. More accurately, that they proved the wrong case. And specifically, I do not think it can be said with any degree of fairness that the statute under which my client was convicted can fairly be said to apply to the facts of this case. This case was an SBA investigation. The tax return, which Mr. Marin says he prepared, was given to the SBA. The agent says that this is, in fact, the tax return that he talked about with Mr. Marin at the time he took this confession. And he says, yes, this is the tax return that was given to the SBA. The officer from the SBA testifies she gets a 1040A, simply wages, tips, and salaries. That's not the tax return that's described in the indictment. The tax return described in the indictment is a 1040 with a Schedule C, that is self-employed income. And it treats the taxpayer's income very differently. In fact, there's a difference of approximately $7,000 in tax liability that shows up between the two returns. The indictment describes that return, the 1040C, but in fact the SBA got a 1040A. I respectfully submit to your honors that the statute in question under which my client was convicted, 7206 of the Internal Revenue Code, has three elements. There must be a counseling for the preparation of a false tax return. There must be fraud. Fraud, as we understand, all of us in common, everyday sense of the word, fraud is taking something you're not entitled to have. Foolish is the man who pays more taxes than he should have to pay, but that surely should not be a crime. And I've given all of those reasons. Most importantly, the tax return must be filed with the IRS. If it is not filed with the IRS, as far as the IRS is concerned, I think it's just a document laying around. And third, it must be related to the internal revenue laws. The tax return that was given to the SBA, which is the tax return that was linked to my client through his statement, was never filed with the IRS. There was no taking. In fact, it was a declaration of overpayment. It is not related to the Internal Revenue Code. It was, in fact, related to what was going on at the SBA.
And but I respectfully... wasn't it produced to, in effect, get something that couldn't be attained because he didn't have enough income?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It wasn't the return that was given to the Small Business Administration, given to them in an effort to induce the Small Business Administration to guarantee the loan where they wouldn't have otherwise done that had the original return been given to them.
Well, that's true, but my client was indicted for filing a false tax or counseling the filing of a false tax return. That tax return was given to the SBA. It's not the tax return described in the indictment. And it was never filed with the IRS. And the silly thing about the whole case is, if you're going to mislead an agency that you have to assume is probably going to call for copies, backup copies, who goes around preparing several different versions of a false tax return? I mean, if you're talking about the 1040A as a false tax return, why prepare a different 1040C and file it with the IRS? Even though it's not related to my client's statement. I see I've got a light. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Molson. Ms. McClellan.
May it please the court. Peter Polivos agreed.
Can I ask you to, if you'd start off with answering the question about the filing of the tax returns?
Yes, Your Honor.
Interesting issue.
Well, Your Honor, there's something that has been left from the argument, and what Mr. Marin was charged with was aiding and abetting the filing of a false tax return with the IRS. A tax return was presented to the SBA. It, too, was a false tax return. It represented an amount of income.
I understand what it was, and to Judge Kaney's question hit the nail right on the head. That's what it was. Make him look like he's more financially secure, he's got a good income, and so on and so forth. But do you have to have that return actually filed with the IRS to violate the statute under which Mr. Marin was convicted?
That exact return does not have to be filed with the IRS because the return that was filed with the IRS by Mr. Marin's accountant at Mr. Marin's direction was an equally false return. And it had to be somewhat different because the borrower had already filed a return with the IRS for the tax year in question. So the accountant needed to file a return that could explain the prior filing with the subsequent return. The return that was filed with the IRS was as false as the one that was presented to the SBA.
If there wasn't even a tax return involved and someone is trying to get an SBA loan and files a false statement of financial worth, lists assets that that person doesn't own, what federal statute is that violative of? I assume it's something.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to, there are a number of potential statutes that is a crime that are violated by that. 1001, there are fraud schemes as were charged in this case, a conspiracy to defraud the government agency, the SBA, and wire and mail fraud as it relates to the mailings and wires that related to the false statements.
So the government had a number of different charges they could have levied against Marin if he conspired to file false documents with the SBA in connection with getting his loan.
Well, Your Honor, yes, there were a number of available charges had the evidence been available to the United States in the statute of limitations. Mr. Marin was indicted with the one tax offense because the statute of limitations is a longer statute of limitations, and the evidence of Mr. Marin's involvement, namely his admission that the returns were false and that he procured his accountant to falsify returns and file them with the IRS, didn't come to light until after the period of time that the loan fraud charges could have been filed against him.
Okay. You might as well go to talk about...
Your Honors, with respect to Mr. Polivos, he agreed to obstruct this grand jury investigation into the SBA loan fraud by convincing his friend, Nick Black, to prepare some bogus notes in return to be included in a file that had been subpoenaed by the grand jury. These notes were produced by Mr. Black in November of 2000, and the minute they were produced, the law enforcement agents conducting this investigation looked at them, and they had suspicion that these notes were bogus. They made that conclusion based on the topics that were in the notes and based on the fact that the review of the file didn't indicate a lot of other notes that reflected conversations. They confronted Black immediately. Black said, oh, no, these are legitimate notes. And the agents took the notes, and in December of that year, less than a month after confronting Black, they took the notes to a laboratory, had the notes analyzed, and received verbally the preliminary results from those analyses in February of 2001. At that time, the government prosecutor assigned to the case spoke to Mr. Black's then attorney. It wasn't to Mr. Black directly. It wasn't in a one-on-one conversation with Mr. Black. The attorney advised the prosecutor advised the attorney that there was scientific evidence that indicated that these notes were not prepared when they were dated. There was no representation by anybody on the part of the government that these notes were scientific ink analysis or that these notes were specifically dated as to a particular point in time. Nobody ever said these notes were prepared in 2000. Nobody ever said there was scientific ink analysis.
How about the analysis itself? Did it give any information about that?
About the dating? Yes, Your Honor, it did. The ink analysis did not come back demonstrating when the notes were written, but there was an indentation analysis that reflected that one of the notes that was dated in 1996 couldn't have been written in 1996 because the paper that had been above that note reflected notations from July of 1997. So the analysis that was presented by the expert at the time of trial was that the paper above it had been written on in July of 1997, so that had to mean that the note below, unless the pad was used backwards, couldn't have been written when Mr. Black dated the note and said it was written.
Who was the AUSA giving this information to Black's lawyer?
The AUSA who provided the information to Mr. Black's lawyer was Eric Wilson. After the information was provided to Mr. Black's first lawyer, that lawyer then communicated the information provided by Wilson to Mr. Black's second lawyer. And once again, never was it communicated that there was scientific ink analysis. Based on the information that that lawyer had about the scientific tests, Mr. Black came in to cooperate. Now, contrary to what Mr. Smith advises is the evidence that is available in this case, after the initial confrontation of Mr. Black, Mr. Black and his law partner were both subpoenaed to provide handwriting photos and fingerprints to the grand jury. When they returned to their law office, before Mr. Black knew that there was any scientific analysis of any kind, Mr. Black told his law partner he had dummied up the notes. He made these bogus notes, and he did them for his friend Peter Palivos. So there was that information, and in response to Judge Evans's question about Mr. Peter Palivos's financial interest in the case, or in the restaurant, it was the government's position and the evidence at trial that he was a shareholder in this corporation. And in fact, after the loan proceeds from the fraudulent deal had been provided to the corporate entity, and as the affairs of the corporate entity were being wound down, which they were done immediately upon the completion of the fraud transaction, Mr. Palivos got his money out of the restaurant. He got a $75,000 check as a shareholder, and then from the buyer, if you will, he got a return on the loan advance that he, Mr. Palivos, had provided to the purchaser as working capital for this restaurant.
Did the government maintain at the sentencing that there was any restitution due from Mr. Polivos?
Your Honor, the government couldn't obtain restitution from Mr. Polivos because he wasn't charged with the fraud and he wasn't convicted of the fraud.
So that's the only reason you didn't raise it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, what was the total loss to the government?
Your Honor, the total loss was something in excess of $800,000 because it is a subsidized loan between a preferred lender and the SBA. The government loss was approximately $500,000, and the lender's loss was approximately $300,000. With respect, Your Honors, to the letters that Mr. Smith referred to during the course of his argument, the February 13th letter and three other letters that are mentioned in his brief. By the time the district court considered the almost six or seven post-trial filings in this case, the district court wrote an opinion in September of 2005 finding that the government did not suppress any of these records, did not suppress any of the letters, found throughout the course of these proceedings that the government didn't ever lie to Mr. Black about the nature of the test results. And further, with respect to the letters, after finding that the government had not suppressed them, it found that the government never had these letters. And it made that conclusion because the people who were involved in the letter traffic, the person who wrote the letter and the recipient of the letter, said, "Judge, we never gave those letters to the government." So the district court concluded, after many filings, after many opinions, that these letters had not been suppressed, they weren't Brady, and they had no value as newly discovered evidence. And there's no reason in the record as it exists here today to overturn the judge's findings. With respect to the testimony of Mr. Black, the district court also found that there was no indication, based on all of the filings that had been presented, that Mr. Black committed perjury. He never committed perjury during the course of the trial. The examples that are provided by Mr. Polivos of what he believes to be perjurious testimony or lies have been found by the district.
Well, you agree that at this stage of the game, it's suicidal to admit that you committed perjury, isn't it?
Your Honor, certainly at this stage of the game, there would be difficulties for Mr. Black.
Yeah, great difficulty.
But, Your Honor, throughout the course of this process, regardless of what was going on, Mr. Black was not and did not ever say that there was anything false about his testimony. He did say, as is represented in the filings, that he thought it was scientific ink analysis, and had he known, he might not have come in and cooperated. But he also says there were never any threats on the part of the government to get him not to recant. His lawyer and he both filed affidavits saying they, while Mr. Black wanted to explore it, there was never any serious intention of recanting the testimony that he provided in the district court. If there aren't any other questions, the government would request that because these proceedings were fair in all respects and there was a considerable amount of post-trial litigation relating to the various claims, and the district court rejected all of them repeatedly, that the conviction of Mr. Polivos should be upheld. This is not an innocent man who is unjustly framed, and so too should the conviction of Mr. Lewis Marin be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCall. Mr. Smith, your time has expired, but you may have an additional minute.
There was the indentation part, too. But here's what the expert says. The expert says that the April 26th inventory notes, which didn't have a year in, had, among other things, July 1997 indented on it. Fitzgerald testified there was nothing she could do chemically or physically to determine when the notes was written. She could arrive at no scientific conclusion regarding when the notes were created, and there was nothing in the forensic tests that shows the connecting the notes to the year 2000. So the government misled Black. Okay, and now, as far as the government continues to say there's no evidence that Black was ever told about the ink analysis, Black's deposition, he swears that he was. And as the last thing that I'd like to say is, because they keep saying this, even though we didn't indict him for it, he was a shareholder, and that was always our theory. Yes, it's their theory, but here's what they tried to prove it by a witness by the name of Weinstein. Here's what Weinstein said before the grand jury. I do not know whether Peter Palouvis ever had an ownership interest of any kind of investment in the restaurant. Certainly no one ever told me anything that would cause me to believe that. I have not seen anything that would cause me to believe that, including anything of the tax returns of either JAPC, GC, or the Catrus brothers. This was the accountant for the, and yet they had Weinstein try to give him a motive to say that he was part of as a shareholder. There was but one misleading after another, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Mollison?
Just briefly, it was the government's theory at the time of trial that it was necessary to file a tax return which would be identical in gross income amount to the one shown to the SBA. But the truth was that Mr. Bazanis filed two tax returns, one timely, which showed ordinary wage income for about $11,000, and then the $52,000 return came in about a year later. Now, the Internal Revenue certainly requires that if you want to amend your tax return, you come up with a 1040X and you show them what it is you're changing. You file two tax returns, one showing self-employed income, one showing wage income. What you're really doing is showing two returns, and those two numbers add to $62,000. And as I pointed out, you know, if you're going to get involved in a scheme of trying to defraud the government, who in his right mind goes around creating multiple different types of tax returns? It just makes no sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.